Thank you very much, Graham. We'll give Graham a minute to breathe a bit. We've got a reasonable amount of time to have some discussion, so I'll just try to manage that a little bit up here. Who's got the first question they want to ask? If you go to keep questions to questions at this stage, because there might be a lot of them, so let's let Graham answer the questions rather than making long comments. But at least for now, we'll see how we go after a little while. Great. Thank you, sir. Yeah, first question.
Earlier in your talk, Graham, you were saying that there were those similar kinds of mutations earlier in your talk, you mentioned about those similar mutations we find in humans. When we consider that human and simian DNAs are something like 98% similar, couldn't it be possible that we could get very similar mutations from independently created genomes? And so it's not necessary to say that they relate back to some common ancestor. Do you think that's it?
Yes. I mean, I think that question is actually very similar to the first one I was asked. It is. So you're coming back to the same issue. Can I come back to my position as a cancer biologist? Again, I got into this whole area because of studying cancer, and when I speak on Thursday, I will talk a little bit more about cancer. But the thing is that when people study how cancers evolve, they come across these very same mutations. Whether they are jumping genes, whether they are viruses, whether they are losses of bases, or gains of bases, or stop mutations, these things can be generated time and time again in the lab, in experimental systems, and they are observed in human patients. And the way they develop is obvious in some of the new high-throughput screening and sequencing systems. So, again, we have on all the information we have, these are natural events. They arise during history. They define the history of a tumor, just as they define the history of a human being. The only difference is that in a tumor, these mutations occur in a somatic cell, maybe a skin cell, or a liver cell, or a colon cell. Whereas the ones which occur in evolution occur in a reproductive cell and get passed on to infinite numbers of generations. As a friend of mine once said, you can know how many seeds are in an apple, but you don't know how many apples are in a seed. And if you have a mutation in a reproductive cell, that's passed on to the kids, the grandkids, the great-grandkids. I mean, any mutation that occurred in my Y chromosome, my son had. And if I had two sons, they would have the same mutation. So you don't need to say these are independent mutations, or they were put there by some super genetic mechanism. This is just basic genetics.
I have to be kind of dominant, sir?
No. In many cases, they can... Sorry, the question is, don't they have to become dominant? No, in many cases, they can just be carried quietly, invisible from generation to generation. Many are just carried by drift. They don't perform any function, some disappear, some become more frequent, and then at high frequency maybe they can be acted upon and come to be manifested. So it depends. I mean, the cheat story, that's not a dominant mutation, that's the loss of a protein. But nevertheless, it's come to characterize every human being.
It doesn't appear to be advantageous in the environment.
No, many mutations aren't. They just do. As they do in tumours. Many tumours, mutations, just drift. A small number, the earliest ones, are probably selected for. So, again, this is another similarity between organismic evolution and tumour evolution, or evolution in bugs, or whatever. Most drift, some are selected for.
Can you tell us what you make of the Genesis story of the fact that Adam and Eve were going to live forever, and then sin came along, and they sinned, and therefore
Right, what do I make of the story of the fall? Again, if we think of Genesis as being, those early chapters of Genesis as being Israel's take on circulating stories, Israel's take on human perfectibility was pretty pessimistic. To me, those stories are stories which ask the question, whence this sin? Whence these problems in our society? What is the problem with me as a person? So Adam is not used as a proper name until Genesis chapter 4, until beyond the story of the Garden of Eden. It's just the man, the man, the man. And it, to me, it is a story about human sin. And when humans broke their relationship with God by going their own way, as each human does, this is the story of every man, then our relationship with ourselves is damaged. We find we are naked. Our relationship with those around us is damaged. We blame each other. And our relationship with our world is damaged. We screw it up and ruin it. So it's a story about human sin and our need of salvation. That's my understanding of it. But I don't believe that Genesis tells us that to start off we were going to live forever. I mean, Paul says very explicitly in 1 Corinthians 15 that immortality is a gift. And it's as a gift that has been won through the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. We are mortal beings. I am a mortal man, as indeed are all people in the Old Testament. We are mortal.
Thanks, sir.
Can you make a comment on how epigenetics works with your brain?
Right, so the question is, can I make a comment on how epigenetics works in this framework? Well, first of all, let me say that I've talked about genetics hitherto simply because genetics by its nature is relatively stable over vast numbers of generations and you can build up history. Epigenetics is reversible, and so you don't have such a historical record. So I haven't been talking about epigenetics, not because I think it's unimportant, but simply because it's not part of the text, if you like. It's not part of the stable system that we can read from our genomes and the genomes of other species. So epigenetics, it's like software and hardware in a way. If our DNA is the hardware, epigenetics is the software which runs on the hardware, controlling the way genes are turned on and genes are turned off. So yes, epigenetics is absolutely vital. People have studied epigenetic differences between humans and chimps. Many genes are the same, many genes are controlled in a different way. So it's an incredibly complex situation. And my research interest currently is in long non-coding RNA, which is believed to be an epigenetic element of the way our cells grow and control themselves. And it's just so complicated, I'm just glad I'm at the end of my career and not at the start. I mean, it would take a seminar of its own right, even to define some of the problems. But yes, it's a very interesting area and important for defining who we are as persons.
Thank you for sharing the stuff that you've obviously studied at for a long time extensively. And I'm going to ask what I hope is a sort of simple question that made up the text if I haven't understood something. But in the days before Graham Clark, when children could be born into this world and ultimately die, never having heard the sound of a human voice, does that mean that they had no capacity to become human?
No. I mean, Helen Keller, I think,
You could see where I've got to.
Yes. There are other routes to interpersonal relationship, touch and whatever. So, yes, there are many ways. But, again, it comes back to the incredible plasticity of our brains. Because people who are born deaf have corresponding developments in other parts of their brain which are not normally used for those other sensory modalities. So the brain has an incredible way of adapting to certain limitations, but compensating in others. So again, it's just a sign that we are certainly not hardwired to be the same.
That's very helpful. I thought that you were saying that speech was...
No, sorry, it's not just speech. It's the total package of human relationship.
Yeah, thanks.
When I was studying molecular evolution, I formed the view that the genome of complex organisms have only barely survived a rolling train wreck of disaster rather than being a perfect genomical thing. What's your view of the new creation and the new body and what genome will happen?
Have you got a sequence for it?
No, I haven't. We don't know. I mean, somebody has said the human genome looks as if it's been a real mess at assembly. And it's got all sorts of wrecks around, but it basically works. So when we talk about the new creation, we're talking about something as yet experienced only once. And that's in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the bodily resurrection of Jesus. So, no, I can't anticipate what that new creation will be. I mean, it's a great thing for discussing around the coffee room table. I mean, will we need an immune system? Because in the new creation, there won't be Zika virus. But we don't know. But we do know that there will be a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness will be at home. And we do look forward to that. And I'll talk a little bit about that on Thursday. This is what we look forward to. This is when God will ultimately deal with the imperfections of our mortality. And when we will, if I can even partially quote him right, Tom Wright says, then there will be full understanding, full reconciliation, and full consolation. But no, we can't give those details, I'm afraid.
Yep.
Thanks. My question is there evidence, genetic evidence, or what might need to be shown for when in a tree, when humans branch off from other primates, how genetically would humans have stayed unique and not have intermingled with other species, but stayed as a species? And the second question is, how might humans have acquired personal knowledge when other primates had not the capacity to do that?
I think those are very difficult questions. And human beings, presumably, they branched out on their own trajectory because they found an ecological niche which suited them and allowed them to move away from the chimpanzee line. So I can't answer that question. It's the human environment, the human habitat, the human ecology, which led us, I guess, sympatrically along our own branch. There is evidence, of course, that humans and Neanderthals did interbreed not all that long ago, because all non-Africans do have something like 2 or 3% of Neanderthal DNA. But again, that's complicated, pure genetics, which I tend not to read. But so that explains, I guess, as all species must evolve in their own niche, so humans did. And now, sorry, the second part of your question. Oh yes, how did it all start? I don't know. You can go back perhaps 150, 200,000 years to the earliest Homo sapiens, anatomically modern human beings. But where was the earliest Homo religiensis? Humans who could think abstractly, who started to worship, to whom God could communicate. I don't know. It seems that my own prejudice, and I'm not very learned in this area, is our evolution took us to such a point where we had this really flexible brain. And then thereafter, cultural evolution took over. And human beings developed through exosomatic chromosomes. And so what makes us human now is culture and the passing on of love and goodness and the other uniquely human traits. And finally, the story of God coming to us as a human being, which is such an amazing story. To me, that is the most uplifting story that humanity has ever heard. And we can act on that, and that changes us again.
My question is more philosophical. I'm not questioning the question of evolution and genetic descent, but I have a problem in accepting a naturalistic explanation, because I'm more like C.S. Lewis, David's point on evolution and evolution leads us to leads us where. But to me, when I look at genetic mechanism, it's all its purpose is natural. And I don't think a naturalistic random sort of explanation is, I mean, it doesn't tie in with the story of creation. If God created, He created for a purpose. And I hope with your acceptance that the natural mechanism is the way of looking at evolution.
Now this is a really, thank you for that question, it's a really important point. Could I suggest that we must distinguish between natural and naturalistic? Every scientist looks at natural process. And we do that without reference to God. So whether you're an electrophysiologist like Professor Barry or an astronomer, like Lewis here, you look using complicated equipment at physical phenomena. And as a scientist, you just concentrate on the relationships between those physical phenomena. So that is exactly as natural as the evolutionary process. Now, it becomes naturalistic when you stand up and say, electrophysiology is all there is. Or Carl Sagan, the cosmos is all there is. Or Richard Dawkins, evolution is all there is. Naturalistic or naturalism is a philosophy which takes natural phenomena and says, that's it. Whereas I, as a Christian, believing that God is creator, understands by faith that every instant of time, God holds nature in being, and He impresses His wisdom and His orderliness upon it, so it remains fruitful and productive. The fruitfulness of natural process is a gift of God. So the difference between natural and naturalistic is that I can look at those same natural processes and I worship. I say, this is God's doing. And it is wonderful in our eyes. Another thing you just mentioned briefly and passed on, which I haven't got time for, is this all randomness? I was going to talk about randomness and order. And the fact remains that no scientist believes evolution is all randomness. Rather, there is chance and necessity. One of the Greek philosophers dreamt that up, and it was reborn by the atheist Jacques Monod in the 60s. Randomness, lawfulness. And as a Christian, that just explains so much to me. That as we look at this world we live in, on the one hand, there's randomness. As John Polkinghorne says, that's the divine gift of freedom. There's necessity, that's the divine gift of consistency. And with chance and necessity, randomness and lawfulness, we have this amazingly fruitful mix, this amazingly fruitful interplay. in which history develops. So again, I thank God for freedom, although I have so often used it badly, and the cells in my body often may use it badly. Different sorts of freedom. But in the context of God's faithfulness, we know that history moves forward. He will bring history to its consummation, because randomness does not exist by itself. We do not live in the empire of chaos, but God's lawfulness constrains that randomness in fruitful directions. I find that wonderful. I have hope. God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
This is just a comment. I don't know if anyone present here tonight has seen the movie The Man Who Knew Infinity. And to me, it's a parallel in the mathematical world of the discussion of and it was just brought to mind again by talking about the concept of randomness, which occurs in mathematics. But I would just recommend it. I can't remember the exact words. I think I will get a download or something and get the quote that someone in who's an atheist actually had his mind open and said virtually, I can now see God in the universe and how the working out of all these mathematical proofs, which were done brilliantly by this main star, are an explanation. A mechanism, a process, just as we've been discussing this evening, of God. And it wasn't a personal God, but nevertheless, there was this eye-opening. And for anyone who has an interest in mathematics, whether they be Christian or not, I think could see a parallel with the line of thinking that you've been given to.
Lewis, could I just ask about the age of the film The Man Who Knew Infinity? It's new to me.
It's just this year. Of last, just last, end of last year.
Yeah.